joining us today, the nationally syndicated columnist, author of 12 books, the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, Miss Arianna Huffington, next on The Culture Catch. Today's show is sponsored by Mr. Ed Bennett and the 723 Washington Studio. Visit them today at 723washington.com. Joining us today on The Culture Catch, very excited to have Arianna Huffington.
Thank you so much.
The Huffington Post. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to be here.
Yes. You have a new book.
I do. Right is wrong.
Right is wrong. Well, you know, before we go into that, you know, something I'm always intrigued by in this new media world, this new internet world, which is bigger than the Gutenberg Press, I always say. Were you surprised by the success of your blog?
You know, I was surprised in the sense that you never know how a new venture like that is going to go. And, I mean, I dream pretty big, but I didn't know how quickly things would happen. You know, we're only 3 years old. We're going to be 3 years old on May 9th. And I think part of the reason why our traffic grew so fast is because we wanted to reach beyond the people who already agreed with us, who are coming to the site through the political section. So we created a lot of new sections. You know, politics obviously is paramount on the Huffington Post, but we also have media, business, entertainment, living, and we're going to be adding books, sports, international, green. The green is the first next vertical that's being launched on June 4th. So that way, we've got now half of our traffic coming from the non-politics section, which means a lot of people are coming to the Huffington Post for other reasons, and then they discover politics. And all my life, I've always wanted to reach out to a lot of people who didn't necessarily already agree with me. I never just wanted to talk to the choir. So in that way, we are sometimes like being linked to by Perez Hilton, and suddenly we get this, all these people coming to the Huffington Post who I'm sure have never heard of us before, and they discover us. And so that's part of what I think has been responsible for the success.
Yes, this whole viral marketing aspect that the internet is so useful for. You know, we've seen politicians use it to their advantage just for raising money. But certainly, yes, you launched 3 short years ago. Think about that. That's extraordinary. And like you said, you've been able to draw in people who might be afraid of politics, who maybe don't feel that traditional media offers them a fresh or realistic perspective on things. Because we do get sound bites, don't we? You know, even if you watch these half-hour shows, they're interrupted by commercial. The train of thought of, even if you're on, gets interrupted by the commercial.
But also, I think what is even worse is the fact that there's a kind of attention deficit disorder in the mainstream media. I mean, you take a big story, like last Sunday's story of the military analysts who were fed propaganda by the Pentagon and then would go out and feed those distortions, misinformation to the American public at taxpayer expense. And that story was a major story, broken above the fold in the Sunday New York Times, but it was abandoned by the media.
Right.
And it was up to us and many others in the blogosphere to stay on top of it, not to let it die.
Right.
And to continue until maybe somebody will be held accountable.
Well, maybe it's more difficult to be held accountable when most of the giant media conglomerates control all the voices. So all that's left are voices on the internet. These blogs, your blog, the smaller blogs that certainly are hoping to gain more and more traction, more viewers, more readers. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest crimes, is the media is controlled by so few today.
Absolutely. I think the conglomeration of the media is a huge factor, but also the careerism in the media, the fear that drives so many journalists who don't want to go against the conventional wisdom, who want to appear to be quote-unquote objective, which often means presenting two sides to a story, even if there is only one side that has the facts and the truth on its side. So that is really one of the things I'm challenging in the book. My first chapter is called Equal Time for Lies. You know, the idea that somehow you need to give equal time to those who believe in evolution and those who don't, those who believe that global warming is a fact and those who don't. You know, you kind of expect people to start giving equal time to those who believe in the existence of the Holocaust and those who don't. You know, there are certain things are facts. And the question should be, how are we addressing those dangers and those crises, not whether they are real?
Right, right. Well, you know, it's interesting. The ideologies of the 60s seem to get swept under the rug. And today it seems like all of those pundits who believed in truth are afraid to draw lines in the sand to say, hey, wait a minute, this is the truth. Well, you know, why is it that people are so apologetic for the truth?
That is such a good point. You know, it's so interesting because those on the right were the ones who were criticizing the left for being kind of postmodern and relativist and not really believing that there is such a thing as absolute. And in fact, now again, the tables have turned. I think that progressives are the ones who are standing up for truth and facts and saying this is what is really going on in Iraq. And you have Don Rumsfeld basically saying, you know, you can't really know anything, basically. You know, it's the unknown. And then you have Don Rumsfeld's successors talk about Iraq being a mixed bag. And you have reporters describing Iraq as a mixed bag, which for me is just like a ludicrous way to describe what's happening in Iraq, just because there's a soccer field there. that means that Iraq is not the disaster it really is. I write in the book that it's a little bit like going to the doctor and getting a diagnosis of a brain tumor, but the good news is that your acne has improved, and considering this diagnosis a mixed bag.
Right. Well, you know, you said it earlier, perhaps they're afraid of losing their jobs. You know, they're too comfortable in their positions. Even the politicians, the career politicians, are too comfortable in their positions. They won't draw the line in the sand anymore. They don't want to play to the sides, although if you look at the right, they do play, you know, the neocons will certainly play their position with conviction.
Yes, exactly.
And I said, wow, they're in passion, they're convicted. Where is that passion to the right? To the left, rather.
Well, that's kind of the Yeats line of the worst are full of passion and conviction, the worst are full of passion and intensity, the best lack all conviction. So that's really one of the problems we're facing. You know, I don't think that the best lack conviction. I think it's more like they lack courage. You know, the courage to stand up for what they believe the truth is, no matter what. You know, no matter how many people disapprove of them or how many of their friends won't invite them to dinner. That's really, I think, what we need right now. People to stand up, draw that line in the sand that you're talking about, and make it very clear that there are facts, there is truth, there is reality, and that's what we need to make clear to the American people.
Right. Who are your mentors?
Well, actually, my most important mentor is my mother, who was an incredibly courageous woman who never had a formal education, but who taught me about fearlessness. And there she was, you know, in the mountains of Greece during the occupation of Greece by the Germans. And she was there with the Red Cross hiding two Jewish girls. And I remember as a 9-year-old little girl hearing the story of how she was surrounded by German soldiers, she and the others in the Red Cross, and they told them to surrender the Jews they had. And my mother walked forward and said to them, put your guns down, there are no Jews here. And because she said it with such authority and fearlessness, they left.
Unbelievable.
And that was for me just the moment of realizing that if you just are willing to take the risk to stand up for what you believe the truth to be, it just is magical what happens. And if you're afraid of who you're going to upset or what apple cart you're going to turn upside down, then the other side wins.
We have one life, right? Live with passion and integrity.
Absolutely.
You know, which leads me back, maybe the great leaders of the world have been afraid to step forward. You know, maybe this constant microscope, we've developed this giant microscope in the media where your every phrase and sentence is put to scrutiny. Your past is exposed.
Right.
There's no sense of decency or there's no veil of secrecy. You know, everything's exposed. You know, young kids have all of their pictures on the website, everything about them. There's no mystery. There's no romance in the mystery of learning about a human being one-on-one because we expose everything. You know, in the past, okay, Kennedy was a great leader and he had his weaknesses, but they weren't exposed to the world
right.
to say, this. He can't be a good leader because he's, you know, he's had seven mistresses or whatever it may be.
Well, that's why I think we need to be much more accepting of our leaders' flaws. And we need to make a clear distinction between what are the really important qualities in a leader and what are minor flaws, which every human being has. And we can't, like, worry too much about how they express something. You know, like, as Barack Obama said, he was very clumsy in the way he talked about the bitterness of people and clinging to guns and religion. But my God, you know, do we really need to spend weeks debating that?
Thank you.
As opposed to foreclosures and the debacle of Iraq and what's happening in people's lives. You know, G.K. Chesterton wrote something which is very appropriate right now, which was, you know, there's something in our culture now that is the strengthening of minor morals and the weakening of major morals.
Mm.
So major leadership positions are not taking as much as a foreground position as they should be. And Reverend Wright, and whether you're wearing a lapel pin of a flag or whether you knew a radical, 60s radical, are occupying the press, which is part of what I'm saying in the book about the liberal media adopting, internalizing Karl Rove's playbook.
Right, right. Well, conviction, standing up for your beliefs, you know, drawing this hypothetical line, it's extraordinary to me how people are afraid to confront the truth. I mean, you know, I think it's imperative. We don't need any more voter apathy. We need people to say, hey, I believe in the convictions of the candidate I'm going to vote for, and I'm going to help them, elevate them to a higher position.
And that's also partly why this is a moment where we all need to tap into our own leadership potential and leadership qualities and bring them out, because I think this is the moment for multiple leaders, and not just looking to the knight on the white horse to save us.
Right, right. Well, the internet certainly has galvanized that. There's no central, you know, it's extraordinary that no one's rallied around the war or the environment. In the 60s, those were certainly huge rallying efforts, and they galvanized a whole youth movement. I guess today we're settled with these viral pockets that have allowed people to find each other. You know, your blog and other blogs and other movements that are happening. Maybe we all come together in some giant, I don't know, some giant movement that finds its own legs.
It doesn't have to be even that giant. I think change often happens through a critical mass of people reaching a tipping point. Mm. It's never everybody
who
gets there.
Yeah. A couple more questions. I know you're very busy. What do you do to relax? It seems like, you know,
I hike, I do yoga, I meditate.
You find time for that?
Mm-hmm. And I have two kids who are 18 and 16.
Unbelievable. Yeah, you find all that. What legacy would you like to leave? How would you like to be remembered?
Oh, I don't really think about that. I feel that I just like to live life fully and not think of a legacy. You know, I think our legacy is our work and what we're doing every day rather than how we are remembered.
Okay. But you've definitely carved out an incredible niche for yourself with your site, and it's allowed you the mass exposure with traditional media. It's interesting how the internet is now playing into the traditional media.
Well, yes, I think we're all becoming more hybrid. You know, our site is moving more into reporting and becoming more of an internet newspaper. Traditional newspapers are moving online. So there's more of a convergence at the moment.
Right, right. Ariana, I know we'd love to have you on longer, maybe next time you're in town.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dusty Wright for The Culture Catch. We'll see you soon. Been listening to an interview with Ariana Huffington of the Huffington Post. The music in the background, the New York based guitarist Nicky Scapolides and his track Meet Your Maker. This is Dusty Wright of the Culture Catch. I'd like to remind you to leave your comments in our iTunes directory, and please visit us at culturecatch.com for plenty of written reviews, audio and video podcasts, and much, much more. Till next time. Converge is the word. Peace.